disciples. And then on the back of that comes this great tradition of Gregorian, what we call Gregorian chant or plain song, which is very particular in the West, of course, different to the East. Western music, Western chant is very different, rather more demure, very beautiful. It goes up, but it has to come back down within its intervals. It's not like the Eastern music, which is more extreme at the top of the range. If you think of the call to prayer for a minaret, for example, very different to the Western chant.
So we have plain chant as the kind of basic building block, but then really, I suppose, in the Renaissance, the time that you specialise in with the cardinal's music, things really began to develop.
Yes, I mean, once the cult of the composer started to grow, and once the medievalists had worked out that they liked hearing things in harmony, thanks to the Flemish composers, I think, of the 15th century, the late 14th and the 15th centuries, that's when music really starts to grow. And by the time you get to the 16th century, there are a huge number of composers writing an amazing array of masses and motets and antiphons. Probably the only century we've had so many is the century we're in now, actually, where there are so many composers, especially in this country and in Scotland as well. So, it was an enormous blossoming of music specifically for the church.
And James, is that something that we're still very much aware of today? I mean, going back and listening to those composers who were working so hard in those early centuries.
I think so. I think the fascination with pre-Baroque music especially is all around us, and it's certainly affected composers as well. Composers in the 20th and now the 21st century have discovered the sheer delight in complexity that was there in the period you're talking about, but even earlier as well. But I was interested in your comments about the medievalists. I'm reading a book just out now on music and liturgy by William Mart, and he talks about Leonin and Perrotin, two of the first composers in the medieval time who started adding lines, counterpoints to the basic cantus firmus, the basic plain song. And he suggests, I didn't know this, but scholars will probably think it was not very unusual to realise this, but he says that it grew out of singers improvising round about the plain song. So the plain songs would provide long held pitches, and initially the other singers or some of the other singers would simply improvise their own lines around about it. And it's fascinating to think of something so complex and highly crafted growing out of something that was fundamentally instinctive.
Is that, do you think, one of the reasons why the church felt it all became a little dangerous, in that individuals were allowed to get carried away, if you like? I mean, church music at times, the church really seemed to feel that music could be dangerous.
Yes, I think you're right to a certain extent. The church certainly felt that music was not being appropriate at certain times. So the Reformation in the 16th century, the reformers were absolutely of the opinion, especially in this country, that music in Latin, lengthy music in Latin, was not what was required because it obscured the true meaning of the word. Everything was about the word and the spoken word and the vernacular word. And even in the Counter-Reformation, at the Council of Trent, of course, the Roman prelates were very keen to circumscribe composers. So you couldn't write a mass anymore on a title of a rather saucy madrigal, for example, which was something composers used to do. They'd say, oh, I really like this madrigal. I'm going to weave a mass around it. And I'm sure for singers, it was probably quite amusing to know that they were singing something that was a bit saucy as the basic starting point. But things like that, I think, are curtailed by Trent.
Well, the Council of Trent, I'm glad you brought it up. We have a musical example. This is from Palestrina's Credo from his Missa Papi Marcelli. And the point about this, really, I suppose, James, is that it's a very pure use of polyphony.
Mm. Well, absolutely. Andrew is right to highlight the continual controversies about music. I think the church has been arguing about music ever since the first few centuries. Should we use the Psalms? Should we use the Jewish repertoire or not? Should we compose new music for it? What's important? Is it the embellishments that make the spirit soar, or the words themselves? And even today, people are still rowing about these things. It just seems to be a constant tension in the church. But Trent was one particular focus where it all came to a head. And I think that's why Palestrina is seen as a kind of paradigm, even to liturgy composers today, because he did take on the issues and the problems about how do we make this music, how do we make these words heard using very complex means? And that's something that composers think about even today a lot.
Let's take a listen. Was the Tallis scholars singing that little extract from the Credo from the Missa Papi Marcelli by Palestrina. What do you feel when you listen to that music, Andrew?
Well, I'm always struck by particularly that movement, because the opening words are very clear. Part of the difficulty for the Trent Council was that words were not always very clear. And it was a huge problem for the English reformers when they looked at the music of Ludford or Fairfax and Taverner, where you could be singing one syllable for, you know, bars and bars, really, and in the sense the text was not always there. So I enjoy the text. The great thing about Palestrina is that he's a wonderful writer for sound. He writes slightly higher treble parts than some of his Flemish predecessors, and he's the most euphonious of writer, and you can tell he's a singer, I think, because as a singer myself, I find the lines absolutely gorgeous to sing.
We have another little extract. This is from Thomas Tallis, setting the words, "Verily, verily, I say unto you." And it's sung by the Cardinal's music, I'll point out. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, this is a fine example of a piece that might have been written in the time of Edward VI. It's, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, unless you eat the flesh and drink the blood, you won't have eternal life." And what Tallis is at pains to do here is to make sure that the word, the text, is very clear, so it goes directly to your heart. So it's not entertainment, it's instruction. It's instruction so that you can take it to yourself and know the truth. And that was very important for the reformers, that the vernacular means that everyone has the right, everyone has the ability to know how to be saved.
James, when you're writing your own religious works, what comes first for you, the words or the music?
Well, I think we need to unpack what we mean by religious, because I find myself writing in different for different situations. There is religious. I suppose this piece tonight that we're hearing is religious, but it's certainly not part of a liturgy. It's not a part of a religious service. It's deliberately written for this very secular occasion, which is a concert. But the music is completely shaped by the text. The text is the inspiration for the music. It's a setting of the credo, the part of the Mass which deals with belief in Latin. And it's in three movements. I wouldn't write it that way if I was writing for a liturgy, though. And when one is setting Mass sections, one has to take on board many things. Some of the things we've just been talking about, intelligibility, the fact that the music, yes, it's going to be written for performance or performers, but it also has to act as a kind of vehicle for those at prayer in the church. Now, I can't really say that's the case with the credo, but you never know. It might make other... I would like to think that it would make others' hearts sore, but not necessarily in the same way as one expects in a liturgy.
I'm interested to know, Andrew, when instruments were first involved in religious services. Do we know much about that?
Well, it starts to happen during the 16th century, certainly. I mean, there's a report of Elizabeth I hearing evensong with instruments, although we're not quite sure what that means, whether they're playing along with the singers or not, or providing other sorts of interlude music. But certainly by the time you get to the early Baroque, then we have the idea of the continuo, so the organ has become much more of a feature. And in England, of course, we have this wonderful tradition of verse anthems by Gibbons and Wilkes and Tompkins, where you'd have viols playing the most ravishing music to accompany the solo lines, which is a really fabulous tradition that we have.
And then I suppose, in a sense, it's Bach who really began to, take the instruments and the congregation and the choir and form something really quite special.
Yes, I mean, various people help him on his way, I think. I mean, Buxtehude does, I think, some amazing work. The Italians, of course, the Italian school, there's lots of them playing around with this. But I mean, Bach and Handel, although not so much for the liturgies when Handel, but Bach, I think, goes to another level of understanding, of theological understanding, where every instrument, I do believe that every instrument, every voice in Bach is on a single track of a theological statement.
Well, let's hear a little bit now from his setting of the credo from the B minor Mass. This is the Crucifixus. Those falling cadences are really extraordinarily powerful, aren't they, in pulling you into the events of the Passion.
That's right. He had the narrative completely in mind when he wrote these sections. He was completely serving the text. Sometimes musicians think that text is not that important, but when you look at the great teacher, Bach, and some of the other composers have been thinking about the fact that they worried about getting the words over, getting the message over, communicating the theology. If it's good enough for Bach and Palestrina, it might be as good for the rest of us too.
So this tension, if you like, between religious music as part of the service and religious music as spectacle or entertainment, for want of a better word, is that something that you're aware of in somewhere like St. Paul's, where tourists come to listen rather than to pray, maybe?
Yes, well, it's a very It's a very interesting discussion, this, isn't it? In an age when the newspapers tell us that church attendance is going down, although I would point out that church attendance is much larger than most newspaper reading numbers. it is true that people don't go to church in quite the way they used to. There isn't the social pressure to go to church in this country anymore that there used to be. And there isn't even necessarily the practical need for marriage, for example. But what I think we need in the 21st century, desperately, is a sense of the spiritual. And I think we see that on all sorts of occasions. We see it at football matches. I think we saw it in the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Huge amount of spirituality, spiritual need, and being fed by the music that was chosen. So when I perform music, either with the Cardinals or at St. Paul's, and you're right, at St. Paul's we have a large number of tourists who come to see us, I think I'm not necessarily hoping that people will start coming back to church, but I'm hoping they'll be touched in their spiritual lives. And isn't it interesting that people buy and listen to Plainsong more now than they probably ever done in the past? It speaks to us. And I'm not talking about something pantheistic. I am talking about God, but I'm not necessarily talking about organized religion and church.
And what do you say? I mean, we're told we live in a secular age. Is there still a role for religion in music, or is it more that there's a role for music in religion?
Well, I think it's a symbiotic relationship. I think we need both of those things. I mean, the church is a human institution. It's fallible. It'll get things wrong. It's never going to be popular in the way that it might have been perceived to be in the past, although I'm not sure popular is a very useful word. But it is woven, the morality and the history and the colour of it is woven into the fabric of society. And I think it's a very important part of that. And for musicians, and that's composers and performers, and listeners as well, because listeners are capable of being musicians as well, even if they're not performing. I think it gives rise to extraordinary music. I think James is a very fine example of that, somebody who produces music which speaks to us on a number of levels, but has this astonishing grounding and experience in the church liturgies in exactly the same way that Bach had. I think it's very important.
Let's hear just a very short extract from an earlier Mass that you composed, I think, just a couple of years ago. It's an acclamation from the Mass of Blessed John Henry Newman.
I should say that this is for the non-specialist. This is one of these. It was actually written for the papal visit. It was used at the big public Masses. But the idea that it was for all those thousands of people to sing, not a choir, although the choir led, but it's very, very simple music for ordinary people to be involved. I should say that recording blurs the line between congregation and choir somewhat. It's Capella Nova, the Scottish choir, that's singing it. And that final phrase is simply a choral acclamation. I can't imagine your average Joe and Mary Catholic in the pew getting up to those top G's.
But do you find it satisfying as a composer to know that your pieces are being performed in such different settings?
Very satisfying. I want to be part of my community, or communities, one way or another, and composers in the modern age have had that constant thirst. If you look at composers, especially in Britain, from Benjamin Britten to Tippett to Maxwell Davies up in Orkney to Cornelius Cardew, for very political reasons, there's been this constant desire for composers to re-engage with a community that sometimes feels lost to the modern composer. And that's not a gesture to populism, it's not an attempt to play to the lowest common denominator, but there are functional works Gebrauchsmusik, if you like, that is in all of us. And I know, speaking to my fellows like Maxwell Davis, that he likes to write for the young person, to write for the amateur chorus. And it's a great thrill and challenge to any composer to have that breadth of commitment.
A huge vote of thanks to my two guests, Andrew Carwood and James McMillan.
Louise Fryer at Proms Plus earlier on this evening across the road from here at the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Welcome back to the Proms. Petroc Trelawney with you this Tuesday evening. The composer Fung Lam tweeting with the hashtag BBC Proms about James McMillan's Credo that we heard in the first half of the programme. Mesmerisingly beautiful, he says. And Henry Lamprecht, McMillan's Credo, a very impressive piece of music. Choral writing is brilliant, he says. Hashtag BBC Proms if you want to comment at any point. Music that you are hearing. Now, Bruckner, next from the BBC Philharmonic and Juanjo Mena. Bruckner was clearly a musical genius, yet throughout his composing career he was bedeviled by insecurities and plagued with doubts as to the quality of his work, which would often send him scurrying away to revise and rewrite. His Sixth Symphony was a rare example of a symphony that didn't undergo significant revision. Near the end of his life, he described it as being amongst his favourite works. The pace of the opening movement is fast for Bruckner. Perhaps he was trying to win over audiences in his adopted home city of Vienna by capturing something of Beethoven's dynamism and energy. One of the unique features of the Sixth, says Stephen Johnson in tonight's programme, is the interplay between major key light and minor key darkness. Bright pulsation on the surface, a dark and heavy theme coming from the cellos and basses below. Some of the darkest music in the whole work is heard in the second movement, complete with a brief funeral march and marked very solemn. Third movement scherzo features pounding bass notes. No respite comes in the trio, which is enigmatic. Other spooky pizzicatos alternating with confident folksy horns and woodwind. Then the finale, with movement, but not too fast, the marking. The enigma continues. There are sections where the music seems to take a moment to pause and meditate. The ending, when it comes, well, it's bright and muscular, but is it triumphant? Perhaps. Or perhaps not. BBC Philharmonic are tuned on the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. And here comes Chief Conductor Juanjo Mena to lead this Proms performance of Bruckner's Sixth Symphony.